The best horror is the horror that feels true. That's one of the reasons the new HBO series Lovecraft Country works. Set in the 1950s, it follows a young black man who sets off with his childhood friend and his uncle to search for his missing father.
A series of connected stories follows these characters around and through the very real dangers of being black in America, and not just in the Jim Crow South. But it also throws in some beasts and ghouls and bloody battles, because after all, it's still horror. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes. Today we're talking about Lovecraft Country on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, so don't go away.
With civil unrest, the pandemic, and the economic crisis, you want to know what's happening right when you wake up. And that's why there is Up First, the news you need in about 10 minutes from NPR News. Listen every day.
Welcome back. You just met Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Also with us from her home studio is All Things Considered host Audie Cornish. Welcome back, Audie.
Hey, everybody. I missed you guys.
Oh, we missed you so much. And joining us for the very first time from his home in Alexandria, Virginia, is Ronald Young Jr. Ronald is the host of the podcast Leaving the Theater and a film and television critic and cultural commentator. Hi, Ronald.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Welcome to the show. It's wonderful to have you. Before we get started, a little bit of background. So Lovecraft Country was created by Misha Green, who also created the series Underground. It's from a novel by Matt Ruff. Your main characters are Atticus, who they call Tick. He's played by Jonathan Majors. His friend Letitia, played by Journey Smollett, and his uncle George, played by Courtney B. Vance. And Smollett, by the way, was also on Underground. The three characters start the series by going on a road trip to find Tick's missing father. And from there, it's sort of a series of contained but connected chapters that are all bound by this story of Tick going off to kind of try to figure out why his father has disappeared and where he is and what's going on. Audie, I want to go to you first. How did this strike you?
Lovecraft, I should say, is in my cultural blind spot. Like, I don't know anything. Meanwhile, my husband has thrust a copy of his Necronomicon into my hand before this taping. So to give you an idea, we are a split household that sat down to watch this. And I will say, number one, if you don't know anything about Lovecraft like me, it's eminently enjoyable. The costumes are stunning. The cars are amazing. Journey Smollett gets to be a fabulous female glamorous lead. And the horror is fun. So it's entertaining. This is not a Watchmen situation where it's entertaining, but you're also head scratching the entire time. This is, in a way, kind of old-fashioned and really pleasant. The other thing is, a lot of people are going to talk about how it plays with the idea of racism and how that, and I assume you guys are going to want to get into this more, what that means for Lovecraft's work. Because as I said, I don't know much about him, but I did take an online quiz once that was called, like, Is This Hitler or Lovecraft? Which gave me pause. I had concerns coming in. I'm just going to say it. And so with that in the back of my mind, I really embrace this adaptation of, I guess, a novel by, is it Matt Ruff, of the book Lovecraft Country. Racism, its abuse, gaslighting, and systems of enforcement are really ripe for horror. And it's just never been used that way. And I'm really interested to hear how you guys like found this as well. Because I'm absolutely fascinated and entertained.
Yeah. I mean, I do think there have been some examples in the past of people kind of trying to do this. If you watch the documentary called Horror Noir, which talks about kind of black horror and the history of black horror. But I think you're right that particularly with a project of this platform, there's not necessarily been the effort to put in front of audiences this kind of overt, especially since Lovecraft, as you say, it's a very specific repudiation of the Lovecraftian view of the world. Ronald, what did you think of this show?
So much like Audie, I am also unfamiliar with Lovecraft's works. I was drawn in because it was a Jordan Peele property. And I was like, oh, Jordan Peele's attached to this? This seems interesting. I started watching, and by the time I got to the end of the first episode, I was very, very into it. I liked it. As you guys all know, we saw the first five episodes. When I got to the second episode, I didn't feel as confident. But then when I finished the next three, I'm back on board. I think this show does a great job with weaving the racial themes into into kind of what horror really means and what horror means to Black people. I think we've seen a lot of different interpretations of horror in that regard as more Black creators are being allowed to do horror. And this show does not shy away from that whatsoever. So I think there's probably some things, and I know we'll get into the specifics later, there's some things I probably like more than others. But overall, I'm really, really digging the show. Very, very entertained.
Yeah, one of the things I noticed about it was, as I said, they're kind of contained. So it's like, as you go from episode to episode, it's very much like, I liked this one a little more, I like this one a little less. They're almost like pastiche from different genres. Like there's one that's a little bit more, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark-y. There's one that's road trippy. There's one that's kind of, you know, Secret Castle. They're all a little bit different in that way. Glenn, you are not unfamiliar with right. Lovecraft. You reviewed this show for NPR. Talk to me about what you thought.
Well, I kind of love it. I love it when it's serious, and I love it when it gets cheesy AF. You know, when we must find the missing pages of the Forbidden Tome, I'm all in for that. I love that it takes that big tonal swing. And here's what I tried to argue in the review. So given that the legacy of slavery is an open wound on the American soul, how you go about making art about it is just an interesting question. You can chronicle it, you can dramatize it, you can write historical fiction that attempts to get your audience to grapple with it. But there's always a risk there that your audience is going to retreat to a place of safety. They'll compartmentalize. They'll say like, wow, 12 Years a Slave was harrowing, but that was so long ago. Or thank you, Green Book. Yes, Jim Crow was terrible, but racism's over. Because what we're dealing with here is so big, so pervasive, it's the air that we breathe. So what creators like Toni Morrison in Beloved and Colson Whitehead in The Underground Railroad and Jordan Peele in Get Out and even Damon Lindelof in Watchmen, they are very deliberately availing themselves of the bat poop crazy, big, larger than life, metaphorical language of horror and science fiction and fantasy. And if you're not willing to go down that road with them, you would accuse them of trivializing the subject. I think that's wrong because what it offers is a new way in. You make your audience take a leap, suspend their disbelief, because the trauma you're talking about here is so deep and horrific that it almost is literally unbelievable. And one reason I think the show works to the tremendous extent that it does is that there is a very basic, simple affinity here, because Lovecraft's whole shtick was there are some horrors so unbelievable beyond the ken of the puny human mind, and they're squishy and tentacled and mystical and eldritch that to merely gaze upon them is to be driven mad. So it lines up so perfectly. And yes, let's talk about how fun it is to see creations of a super big racist like Lovecraft being used in stories that center the lives of exactly the Black characters he continually either ignored or really insulted. So that's a long way of saying I dug it.
Yeah, one of the things that I think is so effective about this show is that the part of horror that I tend to respond to the most, and this is true of Get Out also, I think this is thematically similar to Get Out, I respond to the part that is all dread-based, and it is sort of that feeling of like something is wrong. And that is such a horror. You know, you're in a place, you're in a house, you're in a woods, something is wrong. That's basically all of what Blair Witch is, for example. It's this feeling of like something is wrong and you don't know what it is. When you see these characters confronted by, for example, a white police officer in an initially kind of, I mean, it's not even an initially okay interaction, but even like when they see the car, it's that feeling of like something very bad is about to happen and you don't know exactly what it is. And there are a number of things like that that happen over the course of the series where you have that resonating sense. That to me feels like a good lining up of the feeling of traditional horror and the feeling of good stories about race and racism.
Speaking directly to that part, and there's a part in the very first episode where Tick and Letty are standing in the woods. And as they're standing there, you could see the cop car driving up behind them.
Yes.
And that whole sense of unsettling unease it builds so much there. And I guess this is why I've really been enjoying horror, especially by Black creators, because I feel like the only way to really recreate a sense of what Black folks feel in those types of scenarios is to make things a horror movie, because everyone can relate to that type of feeling. So as soon as I saw that, I was like, ooh, they are in trouble. And that exactly is the tone of the entire series.
Yeah.
To Linda's point about dread, that's actually the Black experience, you know, which is like things are fine until they're not. And then you're not sure, was that what I think it what it seems, but you know, and things can go really sideways really quick. This is something that makes those kinds of scenes resonate. But I think the other thing the show does that's very kind of clever and much appreciated is to try and root everything in the present. So to really explore that concept of like the past is not even past. The scene for me that signaled that in the first episode is, you know, the whole premise of the show to start is that they're doing a Green Book, which was a guide for Black travelers to visit places throughout, you know, the South and other places safely. When you hear that, you're like, green sounds nice. Books are good. How bad could it be? But this actually shows like, oh, the premise of that is driving around to hostile places and hoping they won't kill you. You know what I mean? Like the worst case scenario won't happen. There's a wonderful scene where they sit down in a diner that they could have sworn was Black owned. And the only thing you see is them looking up at a white wall and realizing that it's been painted over. And very little is said, but in a wonderful horror way, it's about dread. Because now in one shot, they've just shown me a white wall with paint flaking. And I am filled with a sense of dread and horror of the fact of what happened to the people who were there before.
Yeah.
And how everyone in the diner now, you know, they didn't own slaves. They may not have been a part of what happened, but they're sitting on the bones of it. And I think there's lots of commentary like that that they're able to write in that you can only do with horror as a genre, you know, that so it may feel silly and campy and weird, but it really, when it works really well.
Yeah. And I think one of the other ways that they do that thematically about the past is present is the use of music to continually bring you back into the present. And I know that you had a couple of the music cues that you also really noticed.
The soundscape of this thing is incredible. They are using music of the period. There are actual performances, right? And people singing. They're also using at times modern hip hop, which will come to underscore a point or an idea. And then every once in a while, they will use like spoken word or audio, my favorite of which was the use of Whitey on the Moon by Gil Scott-Heron.
A rat done bit my sister Nell with Whitey on the Moon. Her face and arms began to swell and Whitey's on the moon. I can't pay no doctor bills, but Whitey's on the moon. 10 years from now, I'll be paying still while Whitey's on the moon. You know, the man just upped my rent last night because Whitey's on the moon. No hot water, no toilets, no lights, but Whitey's on the moon.
It's overlaid over a scene that Glenn would probably agree was completely wackadoo, but somehow this thing grounded it in the thesis of the show in a way that it was like fun and academic and collage. And when I close my eyes, where am I? You know, it's actually kind of hard to tell. And that really conveys that sense of like, is this now or is this then? And hey, that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
I remember watching that scene and immediately thinking about when Elon Musk was sending people off into space and thinking, man, this is how this feels. Something crazy is happening and you guys are sending people into space. But to the point about music, I get really excited about the use of gospel music in the show. I'm church boy my whole life, and you really don't see gospel music used to score a show unless that scene is about church. If it's about church, then gospel music galore. But there's not only in this show and specifically in this show, but I've seen it more. And again, with Black creators using gospel music as a way to jump off. And the one that I really liked was in episode 3, where Letty is doing something pretty powerful. And this song comes on by Dorinda Clark Cold called Take It Back. It is a bop. If you are into gospel music, it is a bop. And as soon as it comes on, I'm just like, hey, I'm like immediately began to feel that, you know, something was happening, but it reframed the song so well for me. And then there's later on in the same episode, there's another use of a Shirley Caesar song and something crazy is happening in that moment. And the same thing reframes the song. I'm like, wow. I really think that everything that they're doing with music is almost as important as the themes, as the acting, as the sets and everything else. It draws me right in.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of crazy in this show, as we've talked about. There's some National Treasure Tomb Raider nonsense that I just love. There's a lot of pulp horror stuff. You know, you create these cartoonishly evil bad guys so that you can mete out some cartoonishly violent deaths to them. And that's really satisfying. But amid all those montages and weirdness, there still is room for these characters to just talk to each other. And when they do? Like, I was not familiar with the actress Wonmi Musaku before this show. She plays Ruby, who's Letitia's sister. And the character she's playing is really sardonic and kind of jaded, but there is such warmth in that performance. So I was really glad when that character gets a chance to step off the sidelines and get involved in some of the show's central weirdness. Although it happens in a way that you get more of Ruby, you don't necessarily get that much more of Musaku, which is a little disappointing so far, but I hope it goes further. But yeah, this show gives these characters room to just breathe.
Yeah, and I think sometimes when you do genre, people are kind of like looking at everything else and they lose sight of the strengths of the performances and how important they are. I think these performances, Jonathan Majors certainly, and, you know, Courtney B. Vance has been in everything forever and is such a classic. He's one of those actors where, like, when I see him in something, I always think, like, well, it can't be a total failure because he's so fun to watch in things. But then Journey Smollett, I think, has been around, you know, as I said, she's been in Underground and she played Black Canary. And, you know, she's done so many interesting things going back to literally Full House as a child. And she's so charismatic in this. There's a wonderful, Audie mentioned the costumes. There's a wonderful piece from reliable costume commentators, Tom and Lorenzo, on their website about the costumes in the first episode of this. The costumes are beautiful, but it's also about, you know, the performance that she gives as this brilliantly strong, but also funny and sensitive and thoughtful heroine. It's such a good performance. I love watching her. I love all the performances. Michael Kenneth Williams, who you might know as Omar Little from The Wire, will also eventually show up.
That's how you get all your friends who aren't sure they're going to watch it to watch it. You know those guys. Am I going to watch that? And you'll be like, yo, Omar from The Wire is in it.
Omar's in it.
Omar coming.
Omar's in it, and there's more of him coming, and I love that performance. I just think this show is so well done, and I think, as Audie mentioned, it's not Watchmen. It's a different kind of complicated, but I think I'm so delighted to see, you know, when you look at HBO and you say, yes, they've had Watchmen, but, you know, HBO has really had a major issue with the diversity of creators that's been documented for a long time. And when you look at, you know, this show and Watchmen, but also Insecure and I May Destroy You, and they're giving some space to a good broad variety of creators. And that has been really welcome to me because I think this show is such a great addition to their kind of lineup of interesting dramas. And again, one of the nice things is if there's an episode that doesn't really land with you, it's going to end. And then the next one's going to be really different. And then, you know, so if there's one or two that aren't working for you, you'll get right back into another one. And they're doing such an interesting variety of stuff. I just really, really like this show.
Yeah, I noticed that because I watched the first episode and I really loved it. And then I watched the second episode and I begin to have thoughts like, you know, we don't have a lot of black shows. Maybe it's okay for us to have one that's not so good and all that. And then I kept watching it. I was like, okay. So maybe this was just kind of an outlier.
Yeah,
because a lot of the energy for me in the second show felt a lot almost like a season finale. And it felt very unearned in that way. And I'm sitting there watching and I'm like, this is way too much to be happening on the second episode of this show.
Yeah.
But then in the third episode, they bring you right back down to earth and in a way that I thought was really well done. And then continuing on with the series. So I'm looking forward to see where the rest goes.
Yeah, it does chew up, I think, a lot of plot in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, it's a show that's for book lovers, too, in that way. You know, each thing feels like a short story. Mm-hmm. And to your point about black creators, I'm happy, too. I mean, not just because they're black creators, but because, like, HBO was the network that was about to give us, like, the Confederacy or whatever. I mean, they were really sliding down a path that nobody wanted to go on. And I think this is really shown in a big way, not just this show, but all the ones you've mentioned, that you are not doing anyone favors reaching out to immensely talented people who can do the job, right? Michaela Cole should have a show, period. It's like HBO's not doing her a favor making that happen. But for so long, this has been the default position of these, I will just call them cultural institutions. And this is incredibly well done with lots of great actors because guess what? These are underutilized people.
For sure.
There's no reason why they shouldn't be leads or playing these kinds of roles in other films. Hollywood does not produce roles for them. And so everyone is going to be lo and behold surprised at how good the performances are. But like Regina King in Watchmen, you know, has been fantastic for a really long time. But yeah, you got to put the star in the star position of something and not in the sidekick position of something.
Yep.
And so we are now glimpsing a world of what it looks like when the talent is not all sidekicked.
Absolutely true. So we want to hear what you think about Lovecraft Country. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH and on Twitter at PCHH. That brings us to the end of our show. Thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It's over at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We will see you all right back here on Friday when we will be talking about Bill and Ted Face the Music.